Dr. Frederick Schweitzer, give me a name.
Benjamin Disraeli.
Welcome to Give Me a Name, where a guest presents me, Ben Kirschenbaum, with a dead historical figure they find interesting, and we discuss. Today we talk about the man who taught me that Jewish-born Benjamins can be whatever they want to be. Or, well, I can't be Prime Minister, I'm not British, but anything else.
Does doctor work, or should I go on professor?
You can call me Fred.
I can call you Fred? Oh,
yes,
my God.
Yes, please do. That'll give us more time, more space. Okay, Benjamin Disraeli, his dates are 1804 to 1881. He died just a bit short of his 77th birthday. He's probably best remembered in the general public as Queen Victoria's favorite prime minister, which is an interesting story in itself because initially she found him disgusting, partly because he was Jewish, though he had been baptized in the Anglican Church, and he shot down her prime minister, Lord Melbourne, and worse than that, Sir Robert Peel, whom she greatly admired.
Of all the episodes, this is the quickest that a guest has gone right into the meat of it.
Okay.
Thank you for doing that.
Yes.
In case listeners are not too familiar, and this was true for me for sure before I started doing research, with the British parliamentary system.
Correct.
So at this time, there's kind of the Conservative Party or the Tories.
The Tories and the Whig versus the Whigs.
Versus
correct.
The Whigs.
Yes.
And, Disraeli and Peel, I guess, would be the sort of defining characters of the early Conservative / Tory party.
Yes, correct.
So Peel is this big shot, while Disraeli is just kind of an up-and-comer.
Yes. Peel had introduced the abolition of the Corn Laws, which was free trade, which would lower the price of bread and the cost of living. And he was the Tory party leader, and that went against the instincts and the great interests of the Tory, the landed interests, who profited enormously owing to their grain, their food products, were a high price in the market. And Peel was a Tory, but a modernist. And because when Peel formed his government in 1841, Disraeli was a young, ambitious member of Parliament. He'd been in Parliament then since 1837, and he hungered for a position in the new government. He was terribly in debt. He was reckless in matters of finance. And as a member of Parliament, he didn't receive any salary. But if he became a member of the government, he would receive a salary, and that would bail him out. And Peel turned him down. So this great vendetta, it's one of the great episodes in parliamentary history of the 19th century, he turned against Peel, turned against his party, and with wit and sarcasm and relentlessness over a period of 3 years, Peel managed to pass the abolition of the Corn Laws, but his government was defeated and he went out of power, and that was the end of his career.
Right. So just to recap briefly, one of the main reasons why Queen Victoria originally disliked Disraeli is because when he was just starting out his parliamentary career, he helped bring down the prime minister of his own party, the prime minister, Robert Peel.
And the trouble then was that Disraeli split the party. The Tory party was divided. Those who were faithful to Peel and went along with the abolition of the Corn Laws, and those who, the inveterate opponents, and the party was split for 20 years. And so the ambitious Disraeli, who scored this tremendous coup in defeating Peel and the government, didn't have the basis as a minority party of gaining office. If you were betting on Disraeli at any age, you would be very sure he would never make it. He would never get into Parliament. He would never become a cabinet member. He would never become prime minister. He would never become such a favorite of the country, such a popular hero. And when he won finally in 1874, the Tory party won, thanks to him, a tremendous majority in Parliament, which meant since the Tories had most seats in the Parliament, in the House of Commons, they could form the government,
right?
From the Prime Minister through all the ministries.
So the British system is kind of, it's not our three branch government.
No,
the legislature, I guess you would call it, is kind of almost combined with the executive.
Exactly, they're bound together. Correct, and the legislature can pull the strings, can bring the government to an end in a trice. There's no term. They have now that still operates, but they have a requirement of an election every fifth or sixth year.
But that's so, also why I feel like Americans are often confused when they're just like a new British leader, kind of quickly, is because they can call it basically whenever they want.
Yes, exactly. And we've seen recently that the Prime Minister, the woman, lasted for a month.
Yes.
And she was she lost the confidence of the House, and out she went.
And Disraeli, I don't know if she broke Disraeli's record, but the first time Disraeli was Prime Minister was also a matter of months.
It was the better part of a year.
Okay.
But he stumbled along. He should have gone out, but somehow he finagled it. I don't know quite how, that instead of going out of power, there was a recess of a couple of months, and then there would be an election. So he finagled, which he was quite good on the back stairs, of prolonging his government when ordinarily it should have gone out. That was 1868, and his nemesis, almost from the beginning when they first met in their 20s, was William Ewart Gladstone, the great Whig or a liberal leader, who took up the issue of the Anglican Church in Ireland. Ireland is Disraeli's great failing as a politician, as a statesman. He probably understood the Irish situation, what was needed, better than anyone else, but he did less than anyone, or worse. At any rate, Gladstone shot him down, as the phrase was, by introducing the issue of disestablishment of the Church of England in Ireland. Mm-hmm. So he went out. And then this was always true. Throughout his career, even when he was the leader of the Conservative Party for 30 years, there seems never to be a time when his fellow Conservatives, fellow Tory, wanted to turn him out. They would have got rid of him, but they couldn't replace him. Nobody measured up. No one had his determination, and no one had his power of debate, his command, his presence, and his ability. He was as fast on his political feet as anyone in the history of Parliament. And he had outlandish ideas, which made him vulnerable. He took up any number of odd causes, which made him vulnerable to being forced out. And they came close a number of times, but they could never replace him, literally.
Yeah. Even though they may have not liked him.
Yes. Yes. They were always suspicious. And even though he had been baptized, he was going on 13, instead of going to his bar mitzvah, went to the baptismal fount.
So let's get into the childhood just a little bit, just because it is does explain this sort of a real, I mean, incredible rags to riches type story.
Yeah, yes, yes.
So born in London.
Yes, born in London. His parents were Jewish. He was named for his grandfather, Benjamin, who was an immigrant. He came to Britain from Italy in 1748, made good, moderately good. He got a country house and the business, and his son, Isaac, who is Benjamin's father.
Our Benjamin.
Yes. He wanted him to continue in the business, but he had afforded Isaac an education to read what he wanted, and he became a follower of Voltaire and Spinoza and so on.
So Jewish born, grandfather, and the grandfather was pretty devout.
Yes, he was. He was observant. not much of in attendance, but when Benjamin was born, he had the bris, and they went through the ritual in the prescribed way. And because the father, let's say Isaac, was dependent on his father, he had no profession. He hoped to be a writer, be a novelist and a critic and so forth, but he failed. And he behaved himself religiously until the grandfather, Benjamin, died in 1816 or 17. And up to that time, Benjamin was in school. He was in school with a Unitarian, but he would have with a fellow Jewish student, the only two in the class, he would have Hebrew lessons, religious teachings on Saturdays and so forth, and he was being prepared for his bar mitzvah. But before that happened, the grandfather died, and this gave this released Isaac, and he got in a quarrel with the synagogue. He was asked to hold some administrative post, and he said no. And the exchange of letter, there's a long exchange of letters in which he's preaching like a member of the Enlightenment and Voltaire mm-hmm. to the leaders of the synagogue, antagonizes them very much. And then the bar mitzvah apparently would have lapsed, or it may have gone ahead, but a Christian friend of Isaac's came along and said, Benjamin doesn't have any kind of career prospects before him. He can't be enter most of the professions, so why don't you give him the membership card for Western civilization and English society and have him baptized?
And at this time, there was a lot of positions that Jews in England couldn't attain, but I guess the most significant for Benjamin's future was that you couldn't be a member of Parliament
exactly
unless you swore an oath on the Anglican Bible.
Yeah, as a true Christian,
right,
was the phrase. Yes.
So you could be technically Jewish born as long as you sort of, but you couldn't embrace your Judaism, or you couldn't stay Jewish.
Right. You had to be a convert, really. You had
right.
to, on the faith of a true Christian. And the father went along for that. And Benjamin had a sister, Sarah, was 2 years earlier, and two younger brothers. They were all baptized, the two younger brothers first, then Benjamin a month later, and another month later, his sister Sarah. And it's thought that possibly Benjamin, and more likely his sister, put up some resistance mm-hmm. to baptism. But that was that. Benjamin was brought up in a family that was not observant. And in fact, his father wrote a book, and Benjamin was proofread it for him, called The Genius of Judaism, which is, as I read it, this is the work of an anti-Semite. He denigrates the way Voltaire would attack. He speaks in the manner of Voltaire and Enlightenment.
And this is Isaac.
This is Isaac.
Yeah.
Yes, and the strange thing to us, perhaps, looking back, about Benjamin was he felt strongly Jewish, but he had all the skepticism and the indifference to observance religiously, but he felt himself to be a Jew racially. And this was one of the reasons that his Tory colleagues were so suspicious of him and wanted to dump him whenever they had the chance. He said things about the Jews being the pure race, the most creative race. He gave one of the questions before Parliament was emancipation of the Jews, so that Jews, as Jews, could be elected to Parliament and hold political office and so forth. And he spoke, and this was really politically courageous. He said, for example, one of his phrases was that Christianity is Judaism completed.
Right. You wouldn't have Christianity if
yeah,
it weren't
right,
for Judaism.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And he made the case, and the members sitting listening to it were groaning, you know, and
right.
Found it so, they were so resistant and found it so awkward. And he finally, the party, though he didn't have much to do with it, enacted emancipation in 1858, so that Jews after that could be elected, and they have been. Behind the scenes, he worked with Lionel de Rothschild, making the case. They wrote, collaborated in writing pamphlets urging emancipation and the cause of the Jews, the worth of the Jews to the English economy or the British economy and British society and so forth. But he had to do that behind the scenes. And when Parliament voted on the question five or six times, and he voted against it,
right,
because it would have been fatal for him politically.
Yes, yeah, so yeah. His party at this time, when he's a member of Parliament, in as you said, late 1850s,
yes,
they're largely, I don't know if you anti-Semitic, but they're largely against this measure.
Yes.
So for him to speak out was also going against his peers.
Oh, yes, yes.
And
yes,
he does it first, and he gives a few impassioned speeches where he, I mean, based off what I was reading, it was almost like Jewish superiority, almost. Like,
yes.
Not just equal.
Yeah. Well, you know, many of his colleagues were anti-Semitic.
Sure.
Pure and simple. Qua Christians, they were anti-Semitic. It was almost inescapable. The support came from Lord John Russell and the Liberal Party, but they couldn't pass it. They couldn't pass it either. So it took, you know, it took until 1858. But had Disraeli waited, he would not have had any political career. That was far too late. And one of the ironies, sad in a way, when he became prime minister in 1874 with a solid majority, it was too late. He was too old. He was tired. He was worn out. And he gives the sense that now that I and my colleagues have made it, let's sit tight and enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the attacks that he levied against Gladstone and the previous government, which was very energetic, it lasted 6 years and it passed a great many reform enactments of a reform, like the ballot, the secret ballot, and things of that sort. And Disraeli kept saying, the country is tired and worn out with all this frenetic energy and enactments and so forth. So let us be calm and coast along.
Let's enjoy all the changes that we've made in a short amount of time.
Yes. Well, one of his achievements was, you know, in looking at his career, his achievements which made him famous and popular don't stand up. One of the great coups was learning that the Khedev of Egypt, who held shares in the Suez Canal, was bankrupt and wanted to sell his shares. And the French, who had built the canal, owned the majority of shares, wanted them. And Disraeli got wind of this on the back stairs, which was very much his element, that they were available. And he couldn't do it publicly because then the cat would be out of the bag and the French would know and they would beat him to the punch or beat him to the Khedive. So he waited until Parliament recessed. He couldn't go to the Bank of England. He had to get, I think, £2 million, because that would be too public and that would let the cat out of the proverbial bag again. So he went to his Rothschild friends,
right,
head of the bank, and arranged for a loan on, what is your security? Rothschild asked him. England, the security, you will have it. So overnight, he got the shares, and he made, of course, as he always did, much more of it than it actually was, as though Britain now controlled the canal. It did not, mm-hmm, as though it had the majority of shares. It did not, and so forth. But he wowed the Queen, who loved the triumph, and the exchange, confirmed her tremendous admiration for him.
And we should say that the canal, the French, even after Disraeli accomplishes this, still own the majority of the canal.
Correct.
But the canal is important in the sense that it greatly shortens the trip to
India. Precisely. Yeah. Yes. the situation was that they couldn't block English traffic from the canal, and that, yes, that's that was a victory certainly. And then, and this might stand up better, the Russians were pressing on the sick man of Europe, as they called the Ottoman Empire,
the Ottomans, yeah.
looking to divide the empire up with Austria-Hungary, as it was by then, and Prussia. And Disraeli and the British were afraid for the canal, that if the Black Sea would become a Russian lake, as it were. And the Russians invaded, this is 1877-78, and were marching on to Constantinople, and Disraeli could not get his foreign secretary and his cabinet, or majority, to agree with him to threaten to mobilize the fleet and to threaten war if the Russians threatened Constantinople and so on. And my reading of that situation is that Disraeli was right, but he could not carry the cabinet along with him. So the Russians got very far along. And it wasn't until they were on the verge of taking Constantinople and the Ottoman Empire collapsing completely, and they dictated a treaty settlement to the Sultan. And that was unacceptable to the cabinet. And they then mobilized the fleet, sent it to Gallipoli. And they brought a force of 7,000 troops from India to one of the islands, to one in the Mediterranean. So and Disraeli rallied the Austrians and the Prussian government and the French, though the French were weakened, having beaten by Bismarck and Prussia, to force a revision of the treaty, to tear up the treaty that the Russians had dictated. So there was the Congress of Berlin, and that was Disraeli's great diplomatic triumph. The Russian gains were rolled back, and he returned saying famously, "I have brought peace."
Right.
Which, you know, what? How many years later, Neville Chamberlain said
a very similar thing.
1938,
yeah.
Both false. But again, that was a triumph of the moment. It was undone in subsequent decades.
And all these things, both with, first of all, I should say, it seems like Disraeli, when he becomes prime minister for the real stretch, the 1874 to 1880, he seems more interested in foreign policy,
absolutely.
As a person.
Yes, yes. Oh, yes. He loved foreign policy, and he was always, as Chancellor of the Exchequer in his earlier years, he was terribly miscast. He came into office, he was in office three times as Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Which is ironic.
Ironic.
Because he was terrible with money.
Yeah. Yes, miscast. but the Prime Minister told him, they give you the numbers. That's all you need. But the trouble was, he was an inveterate conspiracist. He read history as conspiracy. He thought that his opponents were conspiring, the coup d'etats of this, that, and the other. And he himself entered into all kinds of intrigues,
right,
and conspiracies or would-be conspiracies. And that handicapped him a good deal. And he also, he punctuated all of this with his elevation of the Jews as this great race, the real rulers of the world, that behind the curtain are the Jew. He played in doing this. He was a racist like so many others of his time were racists, though he made the Jews the superior race, mm-hmm. not the dangerous race of the opponents and so forth. The trouble with that was that his writings, his speeches, his quips lent themselves, they were quoted by anti-Semites
right,
against him.
It's this crazy irony,
yeah,
where
right.
I guess because he believes in a certain racial superiority, or at least professes
right.
it,
yeah.
then it's flipped where mm. just the race that he says is the superior one ends up becoming right. The inferior one in the eyes of anti-Semites. Right. But same yeah. general yeah. arguments. Yeah.
Yeah. And of all the bitter ironies, Hitler quotes him as affirming Hitler's position in two speeches, possibly three speeches. The Lord Disraeli, he quotes him, which Queen Victoria elevated him to be the Earl of Beaconsfield. Earl of Beaconsfield, yes.
Yeah. And just staying,
a great irony.
And yeah. just staying on his Judaism for yeah. a second, or Jewishness. It seems like, you know, many people, Jews in Europe or Jewish-born people in Europe have this extreme dilemma that if you want to succeed in some sort of way, you yeah. need to baptize. If you want your kids to succeed, you baptize them.
Exactly.
But Disraeli's approach, as opposed to, say, like a Karl Marx,
yeah.
Karl Marx, similarly, baptized but Jewish heritage.
Yes, right.
He becomes basically an anti-Semite. He completely yeah. abandons himself.
Yes, yes.
In contrast, yeah. Disraeli is almost going the totally opposite way and correct. Saying that Judaism is actually part of what makes me interesting.
He says one of his phrases in the novel is, all is race. Hmm. That's the hinge of history, the great decider in history. And the Jews decide history because they are a superior race.
Right.
And behind the curtain, that's another of his phrase, the Jews reign. One of the surprising things about him remains, I think, an enigma, at least to me. I find him able to quote prayers, Jewish prayers. He had studied Hebrew. I don't think he knew Hebrew in any real way. But he quotes the Mishnah, the Jewish body of commentary, biblical commentary. So I don't know if he had this... secret admiration, but couldn't act on it publicly. But he knows Jewish texts better than some Jews, yeah. practicing Jews, do. He was a novelist. We should perhaps say he wanted to be famous. He wanted to be immortal. So as a young man, how to attain that? And first he thought it was as a writer, and he wrote 12 novels.
Not bad.
Yeah. they're interesting. They're most of use because they are autobiographical. They're talking about himself. And in one of these, it is called, and accurately, a Zionist novel. It's a work. And there's a conversation reported that he has with the man who became his foreign secretary that he... thought of that the Rothschilds, that the wealthy Jews of England and of Europe could buy land in Palestine and settle Jews mm. there. And he goes on at great length. It's all, his biographers looking at it say, it's all in theory, that he never acted on it publicly as a British politician. He couldn't. But he does... It's in an odd, paradoxical way, he sort of anticipates the Balfour Declaration of 1917. Yeah,
right.
long after. So he is brilliant, a creative mind, all kinds of ideas, but as I was saying, vitiated by his conspiratorial theories, an addiction to that. He's always walking a kind of tightrope. There are things he wants to do, wants to say, but cannot afford to do so politically.
Just going back to the novels for a second. So, so he goes to school, but he's largely self-taught. He's always upset that he wasn't sent to one of the hoity-toity, Eton or one of those.
His younger brothers were sent to Winchester. Yes,
and he kind of blames his mother for that.
And it might be true, because the public schools were roughhouses, and she was afraid that he was too tender, that he would suffer terribly.
And, of
course,
being Jewish maybe would add to bullying and such.
Yes, yes. Yes, that did happen. One of the things he had to do when he was in the school with the Unitarian, he had to play in The Merchant of Venice.
And he played. I can guess which role they gave him.
Yes, and he, well, in his the novels where he's where are autobiographical of him as a young boy, as a schoolboy, he's taunted by others, though not. I don't remember as a Jew, but he is taunted for his curls or something of that sort.
Right.
But he in both of these novels, he beats the up he beats them up.
Right,
he
right, right.
Yeah, he's tough and strong man.
Yeah.
And he was a colleague in government later on. He was visiting this was a couple, friends of Disraeli, and the man was an attorney and financier and had loaned Disraeli money. And Disraeli visited them, and their son, or their nephew, I think it was, I'm sorry, it's the other way around. They visit Disraeli at home, and they come somewhat unexpectedly, and they see Disraeli in boxing shorts practicing boxing.
Mm.
So that's another dimension of him.
I also want to get back to, you mentioned very briefly, curls. So obsessed with his hair, I believe,
yes,
for most
yes,
of his life.
Yes.
And in general, he has sort of, you were talking earlier about Voltaire and some of the people he would be similar to in some ways, but he loves, as a youth, Lord Byron.
Oh, yes.
That's his big, maybe not for his whole life, but that's his mentor as a, or his idol.
That was, yes. He never met Byron, but his father did. His father wrote a book called Curiosities of Literature. It's a kind of encyclopedia of all kinds of tidbits about authors, literature, and so forth. And Byron had that book and admired it and spoke admiringly or wrote admiringly of Isaac, of Disraeli's father. And Isaac Disraeli's publisher was Byron's publisher. And he knew of occasions when Byron came to the publisher's home and socialized and submitted manuscripts and so forth. So though the father, he wrote that he met Byron and he was dressed as a dandy, which feminine. And so surprised and annoyed or irritated Isaac, but that didn't rub off on Benjamin. He worshipped Byron, and when he goes on continental tour, you find him in the footsteps of Byron, going to where Byron was and so on. Yes.
Byron, the great writer, the great poet, who then would go on to fight in Greece, the ultimate sort of romantic, hero life.
Yes. And Byron was homosexual or bisexual or multisexual, and Disraeli followed him in some measure. And one of the things which earlier biographers never referred to was that Disraeli probably was a closet homosexual or a theoretical homosexual. In his novels, he has descriptions of friendships which are...
They seem romantic.
Romantic, and there's the yearning, the suffering.
And it's usually men that are much younger, right?
Yes. He loved, if he did love, I think correctly, younger men, but older women.
Older women. So, so he was married only once. There are
correct.
A few instances where he seems to be close to marriage.
Yes.
But Mary Ann.
Mary Ann Lewis.
Mary Ann Lewis, who was 14 years his senior?
12, I think 12.
12,
okay. But a good chunk.
I overshot. Okay.
Yes. And as he says, he married her for her money, though he did come to love her and appreciate her later on. I think it was gratitude more than if you would try to define the love that he felt for her. It was gratitude. And he says, he writes to his sister, that I will never marry for love because all the couples that I know who married for love are separated or are angry and fighting with each other all the time. And marrying for love is a guarantee of infidelity. But he went from woman to woman to woman. One of there was Lady Henrietta Sykes, and Sir Francis was a baronet, a prominent But he had lovers, she had lovers, and Disraeli comes on the scene. I don't know, she genuinely loved him, but above all, what she did was help bail him out.
Yes. So just to go back to this, the irony of that he eventually becomes, what's the name, exchange, the position that he has?
Chancellor of the Exchequer?
Yes. So again, this irony that he ends up getting possession of this and control of money.
You're right.
So he speculates in, I think it was South America.
Yes.
When he's late teen, early 20s, I believe.
He went bankrupt with those investments at the age of 21.
And he is in debt for almost all of his life. I mean, obviously, at the very, you know, towards the end, when he's super famous, he's okay.
For 30 years, he was in debt.
I believe he does say that debt is, I forgot what the other one is, but one of the top two ways
Debt and youth.
Debt and youth are the two...
Spurs
for ambition.
Exactly. But he was a spendthrift. He goes to his father and exasperates his father. Mm-hmm. And he's going to bankrupt his father if he would let him. And he could be put in prison out of indebtedness. And you find him, it's probably true that at one point he hid in a well because the sheriff was coming to arrest him. And there are any number of occasions, and he becomes very evasive. He lies through his teeth, deceives his creditors, says, I'm writing this potboiler of a book to make money, and when it's published, it'll be a hit, and I'll be able to pay the interest, at least, and keep the debt going on and keep me out of jail. And he forfeited his reputation, his entree to Peel, because of these kinds of shenanigans. And there's a note he writes to his sister saying he's afraid to go. He's invited to a meeting with Peel and the Tory leaders, they're going to form a government and so forth. But he's afraid that he will be nabbed as on the way. And one of the things with Lady Henrietta Sykes, she introduced him to Lord Lyndhurst, who had been Attorney General, and then he'd been the Lord Chancellor. He was very prominent in the party, and she was his mistress. And for a while, there's this trio of Lady Sykes sharing as lovers Benjamin.
Right, like a three-person couple.
Yes, while Sir Francis is doing the same thing in his own way. And then Sir Francis gives her, I think, £1,500 a year for living expenses. Much of that money went to Benjamin. Mm-hmm. Then the relationship is coming to an end in 1835-36. And somehow, Benjamin, they go their separate ways, but she still somehow siphons off, or Benjamin siphons off, money from that £1,500 a year, which was an enormous amount of money, for another couple of years, until Sir Francis gets wind of it and is going to sue Benjamin. That would be a public, that would ruin him. Any of these things, his debts, his lies, his playing at homosexuality, if what he said and did privately was known publicly, that would be the end, he would be politically dead.
And the other thing that almost kills him politically, kind of right at the very beginning, is, as we've mentioned, he was a novelist. He writes his first novel, Vivian Grey, which I guess it was a common thing to write novels anonymously.
Yes.
But it's soon discovered that it's him.
Yes.
And he's, I mean, kind of loose, you know, very clearly, I mean, maybe he changed the names or whatever, but kind of slandering a lot of big shots.
Yes. And while he was faking it, because he represents himself as a member of this aristocratic class.
And his father says, what the hell do you know about?
Of dukes, yes. Dukes, and that comes out in the course of when it's known who the real author is. And that's used against him as a faker. So he's always on the verge of grief, of downfall.
Yes.
But he had such a determination, and he was so articulate, he could talk himself out of anything, or at least get a reprieve. Mm-hmm. They're not going to do me in today, next week, next month, next year, and he'll resolve that.
So let me ask you this: as a professor who knows about a lot of things and a lot of people, when I asked you who to you would like to talk about for this podcast, you chose Benjamin Disraeli quite quickly.
Yes.
What is it about him that you find so fascinating?
Okay. Well, his Jewishness, the issue of his Jewishness, because I'm now retired, but I was a professor at Manhattan College, a Catholic college, and with the Second Vatican Council issued a document, Nostra Aetate, calling for the review for reconciliation between Jews and Catholics and understanding and so forth. And one day, the chairman of the history department called me in and said that the Cardinal of New York wants to implement Nostra Aetate, or a portion of Nostra Aetate, and prepare some material for use in the Catholic high schools and colleges to deal with and to rectify Jewish-Christian relations and understanding. So please write, or he didn't say please, he told me, you will.
Right, he's the boss.
You will. Write a pamphlet of 60 pages on Jewish history in the Christian era.
Okay.
So, okay. I wanted to finish my PhD. I didn't want to do it, and I said, I'm not qualified. But I think I was the least unqualified member of the department to do it.
That's all relative, yeah.
So I got going, and then you couldn't do it in 60 pages. You would make a mess of it, a mishmash of it, in 60 pages. So 60 pages became 300 pages. Hmm. And then I thought I was done with the book, but then I had to go and promote the book and give talks. How you implement Vatican II and why you should implement Nostra Aetate. So one thing led to another, and all of a sudden I was writing reviews, I was writing articles, I was going to conferences on Jewish history, and I became a Jewish historian.
But you're not Jewish.
No, I'm Jewish not, born. Yeah, not yeah. Jewish. No, yeah. No. My wife said, I have a Jewish heart.
Okay.
And my subject, I grew up being anti-German, though I'm of German extraction. I detest all the Nazism, the Hitler, and so forth. So I went to college and majored in history, and then in graduate school, I turned to British history. Mm-hmm. And my favorite figure in British history was William Ewart Gladstone as a Democrat.
The rival.
Yeah. And I tended to accept his criticisms and dismissals of Disraeli. But then I was invited to a conference at the University of Paris marking the bicentennial of Benjamin Disraeli's birth. This was 2004. So, all right, I went in. And I found him to be a fascinating figure. And I've gone on since then. And I've written any number of things. I've become not so much a Jewish historian, but a historian of anti-Semitism. And that is a significant part of that. But that's how, by an indirect path, I came to Jewish history, anti-Semitism, and Benjamin Disraeli.
And so I didn't know the part about Gladstone being your favorite beforehand.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Where
yes.
do you stand now on the great Gladstone versus Disraeli rivalry?
I think he was the greater statesman, and certainly in the sense of changes in the right direction, the way that he moved with history, whereas Disraeli, in many respects, went against his. Disraeli honored the aristocracy. He manufactured a genealogy for himself that traced himself back to Spanish Jewish nobility.
Which is most likely completely made up,
yes,
right?
Completely, yeah. Yes. Yeah. But that was to make him the equal of the Duke of Devonshire.
Right.
and so forth. But he wanted... You know, his he loved the monarchy. He's always defending the monarchy,
the church
of England, and the landed aristocracy. He opposed tooth and nail the repeal of the Corn Laws because that undermined the economic position of the landed aristocracy. His great political achievement is an ironical one. That's the Reform Act of 1867. And the real author of that is the Duke of Derby, who was the Earl of Derby, Lord Derby, as he was called, who was the prime minister, and who had the sense, there was the Reform Bill of 1832, and that worked till 1850. Then there was the sense that it has to be extended.
And these reform bills do a bunch of things, but one of the main things is that they expand the electorate.
Exactly.
More, the common man can...
Correct.
And I say
absolutely.
Man
yes.
In
yeah.
particular.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And Lord Derby saw the necessity, the political necessity of this, and he wanted to be in step with the march of history in some degree, to move progress, as it were, but within tradition, as it were,
right.
would be his motto. But Disraeli, in 1852, 58, 59, when he was Chancellor, opposed this tooth and nail. He wanted to preserve the ascendancy of the aristocracy and so forth. And then it dawned on him, or he was convinced, that the government, they would have to have some kind of political success. And there was nothing else available. They lost. They were losing out on Ireland terribly, and the Corn Laws. Some of them wanted to, restore the Corn Laws. That was a no-go. So Disraeli finally agreed that they had to extend the franchise. So the Bill of 1867 was introduced, and it went on. The passage was much more well. The parliamentary tactics were Disraeli's. He's the one who got the majority in the House of Commons. The content of the bill was much more, and the sense of the necessity of doing it was much more the Prime Minister, who is known, incidentally, the biography of him is called The Forgotten Prime Minister, because they forget him, but everyone remembers Disraeli. And Disraeli, part of the great attraction was the debate between him and Gladstone. Over this bill. And Gladstone had failed a year previously. He had introduced a reform bill extending the franchise, which had failed. And Disraeli mocks him for that. And he knew there were all kinds of, what do you call them, changes, amendments submitted. And the way he managed them, he would accept some and oppose others. And he accepted one which changed the scope of the bill radically. Instead of a modest extension, it would have doubled the franchise, which actually happened. And he accepted it because the amendment came up, and just before everyone was going out for dinner that evening, and with very few in the house, but still did you have to have a certain number for to continue in session?
Majority or
not a majority.
It's like a
quorum. He had a quorum.
Okay.
So with the full house, this would have been defeated by the Gladstonites. He accepted it when there was just a handful.
Oh, okay.
And that carried the day, and then so it finally passed in the House of Commons. But he was. It was political jujitsu on his part. And this went on for months and months and months. And there was the first reading, and just by a slim majority. But he just brazened his way through and carried it off. So that is his great achievement. That's sort of, as I was saying earlier, an irony.
And the question I want to ask is that, and I kind of, I guess this is something you can ask about most politicians, but I think you mentioned the thing that Disraeli wanted to be famous. How much of what he accomplished, you know, the fact that his greatest accomplishment is a little bit different from what we usually associate as his philosophy.
Yes.
How much do you think he sort of, quote unquote, stood for as opposed to being wanting power, wanting to etch his name in history?
He wanted the monarchy to flourish. He wanted the prerogatives of the monarchy to be extended. And he misleads the queen on a number of occasions when she thinks she has prerogatives to compel someone's resignation from the cabinet or to decide a cabinet appointee. But he honored her. He spoke so that without the monarchy, Britain would cease to be Britain.
All and he her believed greatness. That.
Oh, yes, he did. Yes, he did. He didn't believe in equality. He's associated with Tory democracy, though he didn't use the word. He wrote one of the what was thought to be a clue to him was a novel called Sybil, where he describes the two Englands, the rich and the poor, two worlds apart, divided. They don't understand each other. They don't. It's a desperately bad situation. And you would think that he's a kind of a laborite looking to
help the poor
through social legislation and so forth. But he ends up with the two spokesmen of the opposing parties. They're both aristocrats. They marry, and that solves the problem. So what Disraeli is saying on the last page, no equality, no democracy, that the two Englands will remain the two Englands separate. Though there is the myth of Disraeli. He is remembered as one England, supposedly. The one England policy. David Cameron, a recent prime minister, used that all the time. But it's not Disraeli at all. The contrary. What he did, he made politics, parliamentary life, popular. Parliamentary debates were published in the next day's newspaper.
And yeah, he was entertaining. Read. Yeah.
Yes, that is what no one has been able to match. There's a lot of cynicism about parliamentary debates and and the actions of the initiatives of the cabinet, the cynicism, the self-interest of there. In fact, there is a book which I haven't read called The Two Disraelis, and one is the one that we've been reciting, and the other is the mythical one of that he looked to equality, that he believed equality was a bad word in his vocabulary, democracy and so forth. Nothing of the sort. He was very much a traditionalist. And while when he won in 1874, it was on the new franchise, of course, the working classes voted for him. And I don't know why. Yes.
You would think, I mean, this repeats itself in history plenty of times, but yeah. Because he was someone who came from nothing, because he was someone who was an outsider as a Jew, that you would think that maybe he would be more genuinely for the masses.
Yeah, well, he came from nothing as an outsider, that is absolutely correct. But his family was comfortably off.
Right,
They were middle class, they had servants. They went, Isaac took them for a summer to a bungalow or something. In Kent.
But I do think that he has become, I saw somewhere the comparison to Harry Truman, and the explanation for that was, first of all, what you're saying in terms of, Benjamin Disraeli dies in 1881.
Yes.
And since then, he has been used by both parties as a good example of, I think, he's an easy person to try to compare yourself to if you're a politician, because he's sort of this underdog story.
Yeah, yes. Oh, yes, I agree. He certainly was an outsider because he didn't go to Eton and Oxford. That's part of it. And he was the lone one in his cabinet. Everyone else was a product
and
thereof.
And Gladstone, his rival, went to Oxford.
Oh, yes, yes.
And he was the ultimate liberal.
Yes. He won two. Gladstone won two firsts, as they say, in humanities and mathematics or something like that. Yes, they were as opposite as could be. But the Tories have adopted him as the Prince of Toryism and made him into a Democrat, which he never was. Yes. And one of the indications in the election of 1880, he got pummeled.
Right.
Terribly, the Tories came off shredded, worse than he had beaten Gladstone in 1874.
So his last election, which ended up being just a year before his death.
He died, yes. And he was, he did some speechifying. He gave a marvelous speech on the assassination of the Tsar, Alexander II, in 1881, but died. He had asthma. Had all kinds of bronchial conditions. Someone called him not a zombie. What do you? the assiduous corpse, or the assiduous mummy.
Oh,
that's what after in the last. Well, in his government, except for foreign affairs, he left everything domestically to his colleagues, his home secretary. Was very energetic, and there was a series of very minor, but they were first steps in cleaning up rivers, for pollution, smoke in the cities, legalizing labor unions, making them less susceptible to charges of conspiracy. There are about half a dozen of them. And one is the plimsoll line on ships that you had to have a line painted on the ship. The water could never go above that. As the ship was loaded, it couldn't go above the plimsoll line. That kind of thing. And that is the social legislation that he's credited for, and that Tory governments since time
makes
have
sense, but
made use of. Yes,
but that does go back to the idea that, well, first of all, he was, as you said, he was always a little bit sick during administration, but also that it wasn't his focus. You know,
correct. Yeah. Yes, and there's descriptions of him falling asleep in cabinet discussions.
Which is kind of interesting, considering that when he was younger, he was the ultimate energetic,
passionate
speaker.
Yes. Yes. Oh, those speeches against Peel are marvels of rhetoric, and there used to be classes rhetoric
debate.
Yeah. And he would serve very, very, very well. Yeah, he is a fascinating thing, and I, you know, it's odd. The more I know of him, the less I like him, because of he treated women ill. His conspiracy mongering, his lying, his deception. Though I'm not sure that compared with Gladstone, he doesn't measure up. He was Mr. Honesty and purity of motive and so forth. But with his other colleagues, I don't know that he would that his deception and so forth would be so shameful or so unusual
right
in that time.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Dr. Schweitzer, thank you so much for being on the podcast, for sharing your expertise on Disraeli, a person who has incredible talents and can be said to be, well, a genius in certain ways.
He certainly was.
Then again, as you said, maybe the more you learn about him, the more complicated it gets.
Yes. I'm sure that there will be documentaries and films about Benjamin Disraeli and the Queen, and not about Mr. Gladstone.
Thank you so much again.
My great pleasure. Wish you all the best.